It's Jobs Report Friday, and it's quite a report. We'll have the good, the more good, and the uncertain from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Avon, Colorado, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 6th of August. Good to have you along. 943,000. That's the number of jobs added in the month of July, according to the Labor Department. And that's the best growth we've seen in almost a year. The unemployment rate also fell to 5.4%, the lowest since the start of the pandemic here in the U.S. Joining me to talk about all that and the economic week that was are Heather Long with The Washington Post and Jordan Holman with Bloomberg. Good to have you both here.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Heather, let's start with the positive, shall we? What did you like in this report?
There was a ton to like. Hiring in most industries across the board, except maybe construction, and their great wage growth. We continue to see really nice wage gains, especially for restaurant workers and grocery workers. Fun fact, in the last few months, we have finally seen the average pay for grocery workers and restaurant workers go above $15 an hour. And lastly, wow. I was really happy to see that the number of people who've been unemployed for 6 months or more, what we call long-term unemployed, that declined by about 500,000. That's really comforting. As we all know, the longer you're out of work, the harder it is to get back in.
And there were some upward revisions of the previous 2 months as well, right?
Yes, that's right. So the June numbers and the May numbers look even better. Overall, it's a pretty solid picture, really a strong picture, we should probably say, that America is getting back to work. The one asterisk, when you're an economic journalist, you always have to have the asterisk, is that these July numbers were done mid-July, so before the Delta variant surge.
Right. And we'll talk more about that. But to stay with the positive for a moment, Jordan, the biggest gains, I think 40% of these jobs were in leisure and hospitality industries that, of course, were really hard hit by the pandemic. But staffing is still a huge challenge, right?
It is. The service industry specifically is still looking to find talent because the economy has revved up so quickly that everyone needed people back right away, but they're still finding issues with filling all those positions. But what we see from this jobs report is that there are some signs that if you raise wages, people will actually come and fill up some of these positions. So there are some signs, even outside of the leisure hospitality sector, we're seeing companies like McDonald's saying, yes, we raised wages an average of 5%, and we're actually seeing the applications go up. So maybe as more companies adopt that approach, we'll keep seeing strong reports like this.
Yeah, interesting how that happens, right? When you pay people more, they're more inclined to work there. I went out to eat here in Colorado last night, and right there at the door was a sign that said, short-staffed, it's the new pandemic. Please be patient and kind to our staff. So it makes you wonder how many more jobs we would have seen if there were enough people wanting to do them.
Yeah, that's. I've actually seen a similar sign. One thing that has happened over the past year and a half is just that workers have changed what they want out of work when it comes to flexibility, when it comes to pay, like we were talking about. That has changed, and that's a reality that certain sectors are going to have to deal with. We didn't, even though this is a positive report, for example, we didn't see as much growth in the retail sector. Some of that is just things have to level out because of the construction and garden supply and Home Depots of the world. But it does beg the question of, like, for the long term, what workers will want to work in these positions?
Okay, now back to that big caveat you mentioned, Heather, which is that these numbers are from surveys done in the first half of July before the Delta variant, the sort of the elephant, you know, standing right outside the room right now. Could we see this growth start to slow down?
That's the big concern. And I am particularly concerned about what could happen to women, especially moms. Remember last September, we saw this huge decline in mothers in the labor force because they just couldn't juggle the school from home and I'm trying to work from home or work from anywhere while also doing that virtual learning in so many cases. And what we're starting to see again, at least anecdotally across the country, is daycare closures, camp closures. I've heard from so many people, particularly moms, who've said, I thought I could just, it was getting back to normal. If I could just make it to September, get the kids back in school, it would all, be okay. And now I'm sitting at home for 2 weeks quarantining because my child has been exposed to COVID-19 again.
Yeah, and I should say Heather has a great piece in the Post today about that. And you talked to some women basically reliving the early days of the pandemic when there were so many decisions to be made about school and work. Jordan, you cover retail. You mentioned the lack of hiring in retail, but I'm also wondering how this report bodes for retail spending in the coming months.
So going back to the Delta variant, there is a lot of uncertainty around how consumers will react. But with all of the categories like the leisure and hospitality, those things, that means people are traveling. And so there's still strong signs, especially when this back to school season, that people are actually buying, goods and in some ways shifting to services. So all of those are strong signs as we move into this back half of the year. But if you think about staffing, if you don't have enough, people working in your stores, in your restaurants, as we get closer to the holiday season, that will become a big issue. And that's something that retailers are thinking about right now to make sure that they can meet the demand.
Before I let you both go, I want to just shift gears real quick and talk about infrastructure. It looks like that $1 trillion bill the Senate is hammering out will not, in fact, pay for itself. The Congressional Budget Office says it'll add $256 billion to the deficit over the next 10 years. Heather, any thoughts about how that could affect its passage? Because how to pay for this thing has been a big sticking point.
It has. But the truth is that in congressional terms, that's a pretty small number. That's way smaller than the GOP tax cuts in 2017. It's way smaller than all of these stimulus bills that were passed in the last 2 years. So, and the reality is borrowing costs are very low right now. This is a good time to make this investment. And the hope is that these are things that will make the economy grow stronger in the out years. So if we don't do this, we would limp along more than if we do. So I think passage still looks good. It's funny that this bill got held up in the last few hours over a cryptocurrency law. I think if that's the holdup, we can work through it and make it happen.
All right. Heather Long with the Washington Post, Jordan Holman with Bloomberg. Thanks both of you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, kind of blah considering. We'll have details when we do the numbers. As we just heard from Heather and Jordan, it was a good jobs report. But there is something in it that's kind of weird on second glance. Remember, the economy added almost 1 million jobs last month, but the labor force participation rate, that's the proportion of people who are either working or looking for work, stayed pretty much the same. It's at 61.7% in the narrow range where it's been stuck since June of last year, and still 1.6% lower than at the start of the pandemic. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams looked into how more people can be working if there aren't more people in the labor force.
The labor force participation rate reflects a bit of push and pull in the job market. How many people are in jobs or actively hunting versus people who've given up on the job hunt or retired, for example.
So on aggregate, the labor force participation rate has stayed steady.
Kate Bond is director of labor market policy at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
But that is made up of, in one direction, unemployed workers going back to work. That's where we see this big job growth. But on the other hand, we're also seeing folks who are dropping out of the labor force.
Here's an example of how that plays out. Tiffany Nguyen is 28 and has 5 kids, including a 1-month-old baby. She lost her job as a host at an Italian restaurant in D.C. at the start of the pandemic. Then,
towards the end of 2020, they reopened back up, and then I was pregnant at the time, so I couldn't go back to work due to I didn't want to get sick.
So she left the labor force, but now Nguyen is vaccinated and ready to go back to work as soon as her kids go back to school.
From there, I could just work my normal shift hours at work so that I don't have to stay home constantly.
And because lots of working parents are in that situation, the labor force participation rate is likely to go up, says Odetta Kushi, deputy chief economist at First American Financial Corporation.
We'll see those people come back to work, especially as they're less concerned about the pandemic. But some of it is permanent as a lot of these older workers decided to retire.
A cautionary note, these numbers were gathered before the spike in cases due to the Delta variant, which has workers like Nguyen worried.
I don't want to go back to work and then end up getting sick. It just makes me double guess, like, am I making a good decision or should I just stay home with the kids?
And if she decides it's not safe for her or her family, she's ready to stay out of the labor force a bit longer. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
About 65% of American households own their homes. That's down more than 3 percentage points from just a year ago. And as we told you yesterday, home ownership is less affordable for a median income family today than it's been in almost a decade. But while we celebrate, even romanticize home ownership as a culture, it doesn't always bring out the best in us as individuals. Jerusalem Demsis wrote about this in Vox and joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what do you mean when you say home ownership can bring out the worst in people?
Yeah, I want to be specific here because it definitely is not a universal phenomenon. But homeownership as it exists in the United States is built on scarcity. And when you have people who live in a country like the United States where retiring is really expensive, medical costs are really expensive, and then you tell them that the only way that they can build wealth is through owning a home, then you're going to create a lot of problems if they feel like the value of their home might be threatened. And often what we're seeing is that people who buy their own home begin opposing policies that are really beneficial for the entire neighborhood writ large. Important transit that is helpful for combating climate change and helping people get around, opposing affordable housing, opposing even COVID-19 testing centers over the last year. And it's really a phenomenon that's interesting to observe.
When people oppose affordable housing projects or even just more density in their neighborhoods, you often hear concerns about things like traffic and parking. But there's also often explicit racism and classism at work going on.
Yeah. Certainly. A lot of times it's very explicit. You know, there are several documented times where people talk about people are going to turn my area into a ghetto if you allow for more dense housing, or this idea that we don't want this specific type of person living here. A lot of times people are, you know, say something about like, you know, neighborhood character. And the fact of the matter is, if you are restricting people from living in your neighborhood based on them earning a certain amount of money, you are inherently opposing class and racial diversity in your area.
What do we know about how affordable housing does affect property values? Are there any concerns based in reality when people oppose these projects?
It's a complicated topic area because it really depends how the policy is implemented. If, you know, you could push a button tomorrow and all of a sudden you tripled the amount of housing in the Bay Area, you would definitely see a reduction in rents and you'd probably see a reduction in property values. But in reality, that's not how anything works, right? What happens is perhaps someone proposes building a 200 unit, you know, apartment building in a downtown area, or maybe they say they want, you know, a 10 unit multiplex in a suburban area. Things like that, there's not a lot of evidence that does anything to anyone's property values. And there's actually increasing evidence that when you upzone, when you allow for someone to build duplexes or triplexes on this land, you actually can increase the property value, because what you're saying to developers is that you can actually make more money off of this land. But we do know right now there's a massive economic cost to not increasing density. We know that it reduces wages by potentially up to $10,000 a year for the average worker. We know that it's reduced aggregate economic growth by like 36%, according to one estimate. These are things that really affect people's lives. When you tell them that your wages are reduced by $10,000 a year, that's, you know, a fourth of their income. So that's a really big deal.
There does seem to be increasing consciousness about some of these issues, with cities like Charlotte, Minneapolis, Portland moving to ban single family only zoning and the rise of so-called YIMBYs, yes, in my backyard. Are you hopeful at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing right now is that, you know, for a long time, America's affordability crisis was confined to folks who were lower income. But what we've seen over the last few decades is that job opportunities have really concentrated in a few cities. And with that, we've seen that housing unaffordability has gone through the roof. And it's not just lower income folks who are feeling the squeeze. And so out of that, you've seen a lot more political action coming out of this. And it is really, I think, a reflection of how bad the problem has gotten and how organized some of the opposition to these laws has also grown.
Jerusalem Demsis is a policy reporter at Vox.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
what does it mean to be an effective leader?
That's changed with remote work. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 144 points, 0.4%, to finish at 35,208. The NASDAQ gave back 59 points, 0.4%, to end at 14,835. And the S&P 500 added 7 points, almost 0.2%, to land at 4,436. For the week, the Dow gained almost 0.8%, the NASDAQ added 1.1%, and the S&P picked up 0.9%. In the leisure and hospitality sector that led the charge in adding jobs last month, Yum Brands was up just shy of 0.3%. Starbucks was unchanged. Marriott International lost 0.1%. Hilton Worldwide picked up 0.2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.30%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. The usual supply chain story these days is about delays and shortages. We've talked about the missing semiconductors, the rental cars, the tomatoes, patio furniture and appliances. But it turns out overstock has actually been a problem for some companies. Marketplace's Caroline Champlin has more on what retailers are looking to dump.
If you need disinfectant, Curtis Greaves got you covered.
We got 20 truckloads of bleach.
Greve is vice president of liquidation at Inmar Intelligence. He buys overstock from retailers and sells it as fast as he can to the secondary market. Those are discount stores, Ross, TJ Maxx, Nordstrom Rack. Greve is the first stop for stores that need to get rid of inventory. And right now, there's a lot coming in.
We're drinking out of a fire hose, selling to a guy who has a gallon can, who's selling to somebody who's got a cup.
And it's not just bleach. If you're okay with a slightly older, maybe cheaper appliance, he's got them.
It's everything from your coffee makers, microwaves, refrigerators.
Plus all kinds of home gym stuff that now you can just use at the real gym. Also, clothes. Back to work dressy, work from home casual. Greve's seen surges of both. Dale Rogers is a business professor at Arizona State University. He says with pandemic restriction flip-flops and lucrative surges in demand, you can't blame retailers for not knowing what to order.
This is probably the worst time in the history of the world to be one of those supply chain planning managers.
Plus, shortages of one product can mean a surplus of something else.
You don't need another keyboard if you can't get the computer.
Luckily, the secondary market is built on the unforeseen, says Curtis Greve at Inmar.
I can't say that I celebrate when there's a recession or a problem, but financially we do well. But that being said, I wish things would get back to normal.
Greve says he's lost his ability to predict what's coming in and what will sell. But he says he was able to find buyers for those 20 truckloads of bleach. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
We know you can't always catch us on the radio, so if you miss a day or two of Marketplace, check out our podcast. You can find it on the platform of your choice. one detail we didn't get to in the July jobs report, the percentage of Americans working remotely because of the pandemic fell to 13.2% last month, down from almost 14.5% in June. It's true that millions of people haven't had that luxury, even during the worst of the pandemic. They've been going into offices and hospitals and grocery stores all along. But many who are still working from home are faced now with a decision: go back to the office, stay remote, or figure out a hybrid model. Aside from the health and logistical questions, there are other implications to consider, like what being away from your boss could mean for your career. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that story.
There's a bit of a disconnect happening in corporate America right now. Early and mid-career workers have enjoyed skipping out on stressful commutes, stiff suits, and overpriced lunch salads. But their bosses, well,
managers do not really share the view of many workers.
One fan is a professor of sociology at Boston College and has been studying remote work during the pandemic. She says managers,
they still think that as a worker, you need to work in the office, right? So remote work is something that is incompatible with their image of what a worker is like.
Their image of what a worker is like. For many, that's still someone who comes in early and stays late, tap, tap, tapping away at their keyboard under their boss's watch. And so those opposing images of what a worker should be in the future, it's already causing some stress for workers now.
Whenever their managers send them an email, they respond instantaneously in order to show that they are really working, they are really addressing their needs. They feel they could somehow lose out if they are not being seen by their managers.
This FOLO, fear of losing out, is justified. In a study published in 2013, Stanford economics professor Nicholas Bloom tracked two groups of travel agency employees, remote and in person.
And after 21 months, the folks that were randomly chosen to work from home had half the promotion rates of those that came in. So that is a massive gap.
A massive gap, even though the remote workers were 13% more productive than everyone schlepping into the office.
From talking to manager after manager, they all say the same thing, which is, look, if you're coming in every day, I see you around, I get to know you, I think of you, you may even volunteer yourself for a promotion, and you're obviously going to outcompete somebody else that's working from home, say, 4 or 5 days a week.
Spontaneous encounters at the office matter. Those working lunches, happy hours, and even awkward elevator rides. Bloom says those concerned about climbing the career ladder should try to work in person, at least part-time, especially if other members of their team are going in, or find a job where everyone is remote. But what if that's not an option for parents and caretakers and others who may need to prioritize remote work over the alternative? Sarah Prince leads diversity, equity, and inclusion at the consulting firm McKinsey. She says the burden of the inequities that come with working from home shouldn't fall on employees, but managers.
Anybody who leads a team really has to lean into this moment. What does it mean to be an effective leader in an environment where how we work is really transforming itself?
She's particularly concerned about young workers who need to engage with more experienced ones to advance.
When you think about mentorship, sponsorship, a lot of that is fostered by us finding a personal connection in another human being where we see ourselves in them.
And big picture, she says this work from home conundrum is about much more than the careers of a few people.
There is a real risk that people with diverse backgrounds and identities will be left behind.
The pandemic has already widened the workforce gap for women and people of color. And without a careful look at how a remote, out of sight, out of mind workplace could increase biases against them, that gap could keep growing. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out from the Federal Reserve: Americans are putting a lot of that increased spending on vacations and dining and cars on credit. Total consumer credit grew by $30 billion in June. The 10.6% annualized increase was the fastest in a decade. Revolving credit, including credit cards, was up 22%. Again, this was before Delta. But before we get too worried about all that debt people are taking on, we're also still on the whole saving more than before the pandemic. All right, that's it for this week. But before we go, here's your Friday moment of economic context. Context to consider when thinking about women and the workforce. A new study out of UCLA found that having a baby really does age you. Researchers found that 1 year after a birth, mothers who had slept less than 7 hours a night had aged, biologically speaking, 3 to 7 years. I know, 7 hours of sleep, try zero some nights. Whether the aging effect lasts has yet to be studied. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.